For LibertarianChristians.com, I'm Norman Horn. You're listening to the LCC Podcast. Okay, welcome to this edition of the LCC Podcast. This is your host, Norman. I've been really busy and I didn't get the podcast out last Friday. But here it is today, continuing Christianity and War, an essay called War, Foreign Policy, and the Church. The book's by Lawrence Vance. Hope you've gotten a copy at some point or another. This is part two of that essay. If you haven't listened to the previous part, you might want to, as it will probably help you out. So, War, Foreign Policy, and the Church, part two. All of these things being said, I would now at long last like to give you 10 things the Church should be saying about war and foreign policy. But instead of appealing to the latest pronouncement of one of our self-anointed Christian leaders who moonlights as a cheerleader for the Bush administration, I appeal to Scripture. To the U.S. government, the Church should be saying 10 things. 1. Ephesians 4:29. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth. The communication that comes forth from U.S. government officials is routinely corrupt communication. In response to the charge that more than 500,000 children in Iraq died as a result of U.S. sanctions, soon-to-be Secretary of State Madeleine Albright responded that the price was worth it. Commenting on new interrogation techniques he approved that included forcing prisoners to stand for 4 hours at a time, then-Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld arrogantly wrote, "I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day. Why is standing limited to 4 hours?" On the eve of the Persian Gulf War, the senior President Bush stated, "And so to every sailor, soldier, airman, and marine who is involved in this mission, let me say, you're doing God's work." He also remarked once when he was the vice president, "I will never apologize for the United States of America. I don't care what the facts are." This corrupt communication has increased under the current president, as this statement from George W. shows. "No act of America explains terrorist violence, and no concession of America could appease it. Like father, like son." 2. Romans 12:17. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. Dishonesty is the rule when it comes to the U.S. government. Who can forget FDR on the eve of U.S. intervention into World War II? "I have said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars. They are going into training to form a force so strong that, by its very existence, it will keep the threat of war far away from our shores." And what about LBJ campaigning for president in 1964? "We are not about to send American boys 9 or 10,000 miles away from home to do what Asian boys ought to be doing for themselves." And then there is our current president. Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. 3. 1 Thessalonians 5:15. Ever follow that which is good. Although Madeleine Albright once made the claim, "The United States is good," we have not ever followed that which is good. The Scripture says that righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. The United States could and should be the moral leader of the world. Old Right Senator Robert Taft once remarked that, "If we confine our activities to the field of moral leadership, we shall be successful if our philosophy is sound and appeals to the people of the world." The problem with this, as Taft also recognized, is that the United States wants to force on foreigners, through the use of American money and even, perhaps, arms, the policies which moral leadership is able to advance only through the sound strength of its principles. And as old right Republican Congressman Howard Buffett explained, "Our Christian ideals cannot be exported to other lands by dollars and guns. Persuasion and example are the methods taught by the carpenter of Nazareth." 4. Galatians 6:10. "As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men." Miss Albright also said of the United States, "We try to do our best everywhere." This too is incorrect, for the United States does not do good unto all men. In many cases, we do just the opposite. Just ask those who have lost loved ones, limbs, or property from U.S. mines, bombs, and bullets. In a speech at a NATO summit before the invasion of Iraq, President Bush said, "Great evil is stirring in the world." Although the president would disagree, more often than not, it is the United States that commits evil deeds or stirs up evil in the world. 5. Ephesians 5:11. Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. The U.S. government, through the CIA, the military, and the State Department, has regularly maintained cozy relationships with dictators, thugs, strongmen, and other corrupt rulers who commit works of darkness, as well as committing numerous works of darkness. Donald Rumsfeld should forever be haunted by the picture of him and Saddam Hussein taken in 1983 when he was sent to Iraq as a special envoy of President Reagan. Although the United States restored formal relations with Iraq in 1984, we had already begun, even before Rumsfeld made his trip, to secretly provide Iraq with intelligence and military support, contrary to our official neutrality in the Iran-Iraq War, and knowing that Iraq had used chemical weapons. The United States has committed numerous works of darkness, including assassinations, propaganda campaigns, regime changes, and covert actions. 6. Romans 12:17. Recompense to no man evil for evil. The world is full of evil. Always has been, always will be. I believe it was Edward Gibbon who said, "History is indeed little more than the register of the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind." When evil is committed against the United States, we should first seek to discover why it happened before we recompense evil for evil by sending in the Marines. As much as it pains me to say it, most of the evil perpetrated against the United States is in response to our interventionist foreign policy. 7. 1 Peter 4:15. Don't be a busybody in other men's matters. No one likes a busybody. People universally prefer that others mind their own business. The United States is a global busybody with bombs. Supposedly, sovereign countries can't even have an election without the United States intervening in one way or another. Fraud or no fraud, foreign elections are none of our business. How would we feel if China or Russia sent observers to monitor our elections because of the recent cases of fraud? We would be furious. And as much as many Americans loathe George W. Bush, how would we feel if another country said that we needed to submit to a regime change? We would likewise be outraged. Most of what happens in the world is none of our concern, and certainly none of our business. Why do we wonder that the rest of the world objects to us sticking our nose in their business? 8. 1 Timothy 5:21. Doing nothing by partiality. Instead of doing nothing by partiality, the United States regularly does just the opposite. In fact, the history of U.S. foreign policy is the history of showing partiality to one country over another or being partial to a country if it serves some policy objective, even if it means turning a blind eye to that country's ruler, system of government, human rights violations, treatment of women, economic policies, or religious intolerance. 9. Romans 12:18. Live peaceably with all men. Even though there is an abundance of evil in the world, there is no reason why the United States cannot live peaceably with the rest of the world. When the scripture simply says to live peaceably, it doesn't imply that you should make your opponents die so you can live peaceably. The scripture also says to live peaceably with all men. That would include countries that are communist or Muslim. It doesn't matter what form of government, type of ruler, or national policies a country has. We can live peaceably by recognizing that there is nothing we can do about most of the evil in the world. We can live peaceably by realizing that we cannot remake the world in our image. And most importantly, we can live peaceably by not being the cause of evil in the world. 10. Exodus 20:13. Thou shalt not kill. God only knows how many people around the world have been killed as a direct result of U.S. foreign policy. No, I am not equating the United States with Nazi Germany, Soviet Russia, or Red China. With the exception of Indians, the United States generally kills foreigners, not American citizens. We killed at least 2 million Vietnamese and Cambodians in a war that was both undeclared and unnecessary. We have now killed or been responsible for the deaths of perhaps 500,000 people in Iraq. From the beginning of the Iraq War, I have maintained that participants in this evil war violate the express teaching of the biblical commandment against killing. Christian apologists for war say that either the commandments don't apply to the state, and therefore killing done in service for the state is permissible, or else that the Sixth Commandment is limited to murder, and therefore killing done in wartime is permissible. Therefore, just as Calvary covers it all, my past with its sin and shame, so the wearing of a uniform covers it all, my military service with its death and destruction. Thus, killing someone you don't know and have never seen, in his own territory, who was no threat to anyone until the United States invaded his country, is not murder if the U.S. government says that he should be killed. No soldier is responsible for the death and destruction he inflicts in a foreign country as long as it is state-sanctioned death and destruction. I reject this ghastly statolatry. There is an unholy desire on the part of some Christians to legitimize killing and war. They have the attitude that what is required conduct for individuals is not required conduct for nations. In the minds of some Christians, it is okay for someone to put on a uniform and kill someone halfway around the world, but it is murder if the same person killed someone here in the United States. Although it was Oliver Cromwell who said that, "There are great occasions in which some men are called to great services in the doing of which they are excused from the common rule of morality." Even a nominal Christian like Thomas Jefferson spoke against this mindset, writing in a letter to James Madison in 1789, "I know but one code of morality for men, whether acting singly or collectively. He who says I will be a rogue when I act in company with 100 others, but an honest man when I act alone, will be believed in the former assertion, but not in the latter." A man does not throw his morality out the window just because he puts on a uniform. There is nothing inherently religious about what the Church should be saying about war and foreign policy. It is merely aversion to war and the non-interventionist foreign policy of the Founding Fathers. A non-interventionist foreign policy is not just an old right foreign policy, a libertarian foreign policy, or a paleoconservative foreign policy, it is a Jeffersonian foreign policy. Jefferson believed in no judgment, no meddling, no political connection, no partiality, no war, and no entangling alliances. What is wrong with the wisdom of Jefferson? How much wiser were the Founding Fathers than Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Powell, Rice, and the other architects of the Iraq War? What would a non-interventionist foreign policy look like? We haven't had one in so long that it might be hard to imagine what it would be like. Perhaps it would be better to consider what a non-interventionist foreign policy would not look like. Having a non-interventionist foreign policy doesn't mean that the United States should refuse to participate in the Olympics, refuse to make treaties, refuse to issue visas, refuse to trade with other countries, refuse to allow foreign investment, refuse to extradite criminals, refuse to mediate disputes, refuse to exchange diplomats, refuse to allow cultural exchanges, refuse to allow travel abroad, or refuse to allow immigration. A non-interventionist foreign policy would not be an isolationist foreign policy. The word isolationism is a pejorative term of intimidation used to stifle debate over foreign policy. No advocate of non-intervention in foreign affairs wants to build a fortified fence around the United States and retreat behind it, as Clinton's national security advisor Sandy Berger smeared opponents of an interventionist U.S. foreign policy. In his 2006 State of the Union speech, President Bush did the same thing, thrice warning us of the danger of retreating into isolationism. A non-interventionist foreign policy is a policy of peace, neutrality, and free trade. A non-interventionist foreign policy would mean no more invasions, no more threats, no more sanctions, no more embargoes, no more spies, no more meddling, no more bullying, no more foreign entanglements, no more entangling alliances, no more military advisors, no more troops and bases on foreign soil, no more NATO-like commitments, no more trying to be the world's social worker, fireman, and policeman. No more nation building. No more peacekeeping operations. No more covert actions. No more forcibly opening markets. No more enforcing UN resolutions. No more liberations. And no more shooting, bombing, maiming, and killing. A non-interventionist foreign policy would also mean no foreign aid, no humanitarian aid, no disaster relief, and no payments to the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, or the World Bank. Would a non-interventionist foreign policy mean that individual Americans could not or would not help foreigners? Of course not. But those who desire not to provide assistance should not be forced to pay for it with their tax dollars. The United States cannot police the world. We have no right to police the world. It is the height of arrogance to try and remake the world in our image. Most of what happens in the world is none of our concern, and certainly none of our business. It is not the responsibility of the United States to remove corrupt rulers and oppressive dictators from power. The kind of government a country has and the type of leader it has is the sole responsibility of the people in that country. There is absolutely no reason why the United States would be justified in attacking and invading a sovereign country. No matter what we thought of that country's ruler, system of government, treatment of women, economic policies, religious intolerance, or human rights record, if the people in a country don't like their ruler, then they should get rid of him themselves and not expect the United States to intervene. The truth of the matter is that the handful of men who hold political power in a country cannot, in and of themselves, compel that country's citizens to obey them in every respect. They have to have the cooperation of the people. If an individual American feels so strongly about one side in a civil war or border dispute, then he can send money to the side he favors, pray for one side to be victorious, or enlist in the army of his preferred side. That is, anything but call for sending in the U.S. Marines. How strange it is that advocates of U.S. military interventions consider us non-interventionists to be unpatriotic and anti-American when we are the ones concerned about the life of even one American being used as cannon fodder for the state. We never considered the shedding of the blood of even one American to be worth the latest lie that U.S. troops are dying for. So what should the United States do? In the words of the late Murray Rothbard, the United States should abandon its policy of global interventionism, withdraw immediately and completely, militarily and politically, from everywhere, and maintain a policy of strict political isolation or neutrality everywhere. Political isolation is the only isolation we desire. Once we bring the troops home from around the globe, strict limits should be set to keep them home. Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler recommended a peace amendment that would prohibit the removal of the Army from U.S. soil, limit the distance that Navy ships could steam from our coast, and limit the distance that military aircraft could fly from our borders. I would like to say something in conclusion about civil liberties. Intervention abroad cannot but follow intervention at home. There is no way a country can have hundreds of foreign bases and thousands of troops stationed overseas without a massive and oppressive bureaucracy at home. Conservative godfather and cold warrior William F. Buckley admitted as much back in the early 1950s. We have to accept big government for the duration, for neither an offensive nor a defensive war can be waged, given our present government skills, except through the instrumentality of a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores. Buckley went on to recommend that we support large armies and air forces, atomic energy, central intelligence, war production boards, and the attendant centralization of power in Washington. William Jennings Bryan articulated a better idea over 100 years ago. We assert that no nation can long endure half republic and half empire, and we warn the American people that imperialism abroad will lead quickly and inevitably to despotism at home. The state uses war to strip its citizens of their liberties. The state uses war to strip its citizens of their liberties. The authority of the legislature and the force of law that, at least in principle, thwart government power in peacetime quickly diminish during times of war. The father of the Constitution, James Madison, said about the relationship between war and civil liberty, "If tyranny and oppression come to this land, it will be in the guise of fighting a foreign enemy." Throughout the 20th century, interventionism was the guiding principle of U.S. foreign policy under either political party. The 9/11 attacks were just the beginning of a worldwide revolt against U.S. imperialism and empire. Of all people, Christians should know the truth and speak the truth about the evils of U.S. wars and foreign policy. They should see Bush's rhetoric about extending the benefits of freedom across the globe and enlarging the realm of liberty for what it is: plain, old-fashioned interventionism, pure and simple. Only a Jeffersonian foreign policy of peace, commerce, friendship, and no entangling alliances can cut the tentacles of U.S. global interventionism. Can any Christian honestly say that Bush's principles are better than Jefferson's principles?